Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The end of the year is traditionally a time to review the major events of the year just ending. As is the case every year, the list is surprisingly long, 2013 no exception. This was a year in which Stan Musial died and two convicted killers were executed in Missouri. Gay marriage and pension reform got a thumbs up in Illinois. A Missouri State Fair clown made national headlines, and Father Larry Biondi bowed to pressure to step down. These stories and more, just part of our year-end review, we'll be asking you what events you believe had the most impact on you and on the region. I'm Don Marsh. Joining me in studio during the course of the program to talk about events of the past year, some of the St. Louis Public Radio and Beacon staffers who covered them. But we begin with St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon editor, Margie Freivogel. Margie, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here with you, Don.
And Happy New Year to you
as well. Same to you.
This is really a very subjective exercise, is it not, this picking out the top stories of the past year?
Very subjective, and I think any individual would have a different list depending on what's important to them. But there are some commonalities, I think.
What are the criteria for top story?
Well, for me, it would be the lasting significance of the story. How much does it impact our lives going forward?
And do you have a one picked out for this year that you find meet those criteria?
I think the top story for me is really, in general, educational quality and inequality. It played out very dramatically with the student transfer issue. It's also an issue in the Ferguson-Florissant schools with the questions about whether Art McCoy will continue as superintendent. I think it really has dominated people's consciousness, and it relates not only to what's going to happen to the students in school now, but what's the future of our region? How are we building up our resources so that we're in a position to move forward?
We'll be talking about that in a little more detail with Tim Lloyd in just a couple of moments. Is there any story that you think was overplayed this year?
Well, I often have that reaction to stories, but I think the one I might pick out as the supreme overplayed story this year might be the Larry Connors episode. Sort of blew up. He implied that he was being picked on by the government because he asked tough questions. There didn't really seem to be any evidence of that. And yet the story continued.
That's because he keeps filing lawsuits.
Yes, he does.
He's relentless, and that I'm glad I don't have to pay his legal bills. For those who don't know, and I can't imagine there are too many people in the audience who don't, Larry Connors, former anchorman at KMOV Channel 4. How about underplayed?
I was thinking about that. There's a story that's oddly, in a way, overplayed and underplayed. And what I'm thinking of is the discussion of the Del Mar Divide. I say overplayed only in that the BBC came in, did a short piece that was, in a way, oversimplified about the racial and economic divide that's marked by Del Mar. And yet underplayed because there really is a divide. It is a very substantive, longstanding issue. And the issue of race in general, we often find hard to talk about here, hard to get a handle on, although I think maybe we're doing a little bit better with it.
Underplayed perhaps because people in the lower end of the socioeconomic scale are invisible to a lot of us.
They can be.
Yeah.
Although, you know, we're in a sense, one region. So what happens to people who we may be ignoring really does make a difference to everyone.
I noticed the Associated Press and some other news organizations, as they typically do, come up with their top 10 stories. And picked this time by many of them was the double execution, if you will, the two executions here in the state of Missouri. That surprised me a little bit, in a sense, because the impact of that was relatively limited, I thought.
Well, perhaps, but it certainly raises a number of ethical, legal, philosophical questions that are of great importance to people and kind of define who we are as a society.
Well, this organization has been all over that story and has been for several months with regard to these two executions. Let's bring in Chris McDaniel now, the St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon staff. Chris, you've been covering this story throughout. Really, the story was less the executions themselves, it seems to me, than the manner in which they were executed. We'll talk about that, and then we'll talk about the story you're breaking today along with Veronique LaCapra.
Sure. Well, you really nailed it there. It's less about the people who have been executed and more about what the state is doing in order to be able to carry out executions. So just to refresh people on what's been going on, in mid-October, the governor decided that the state of Missouri was going to come up with a new drug to carry out executions. The problem with the previous drug was that most of it was made in the European Union. The European Union is obviously very anti-death penalty. So there's a pretty good possibility that there would have been some sanctions taken against the United States if Missouri had gone through with this execution. So the governor directed the Department of Corrections to come up with a new way to carry out executions. What they came up with was a drug called pentobarbital. There were really two big issues with their new way of carrying out executions. One is that they're going to obtain it from something called a compounding pharmacy. And compounding pharmacies are different from drug manufacturers because the drugs that they make aren't regulated by the FDA. They're supposed to be regulated by the states. The other issue was they granted new secrecy to the person that's supplying this drug or the company that's supplying this drug. So it really restricted the amount of oversight that the public can have here, or the lawyers, for that matter.
We have extensive coverage of your reportage on this, your reporting on this, on our website at stlpublicradio.org. And looking at that this morning, I was really struck by the amount of redacted information on the various documents that you've come up with.
Yes. We, for the story that aired today, we had, dozens upon dozens of pages from Sunshine requested documents. And yes, they were all heavily redacted, but by piecing them together, we were able to find out where the state of Missouri is obtaining its execution drug. And what we found out was that the compounding pharmacy that is selling the state of Missouri its execution drug isn't licensed to sell drugs in the state of Missouri. And that's important. That's not just a typical regulatory oversight or anything like that. It's important because, as we mentioned before, compounding pharmacies aren't regulated by the FDA. And the thought process behind it is, well, they'll be regulated by the states. And in this case, it's not regulated by Missouri.
So Missouri is breaking the law in order to, in a sense, uphold the law.
So under normal circumstances, this would be a Class C felony, which would be punishable by up to 7 years in prison. This case, since it's, very different than what a normal situation would be. It's tough to say. We've spoken to several legal experts about this, and they said that it was a gray area in terms of, if they were actually breaking the law or if they would be prosecuted. So far, the Missouri Board of Pharmacy hasn't given any indication that they'll be investigating or going after this pharmacy.
So you really wouldn't expect the state to prosecute itself or to prosecute the pharmacy that it's buying from. But on the other hand, it raises a question. If you can ignore the rule in this case, then what's the point of having it in other cases?
Exactly. Ethical issues involved in this as well.
There are. I mean, this is somewhat common sense, but the drug that they use to carry out executions is extremely important. And the reason for that being is if you have a drug that isn't sterile or isn't as potent as it's supposed to be, or even isn't what it's the type of drug that it's supposed to be, then you're going to have possibly a slow and painful death. And obviously that's something that's restricted by the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution.
Right. Cruel and unusual punishment.
Exactly.
Is what that boils down to. No real comment at all from the state.
So far, they have declined to comment. Both the Attorney General and the Governor's Office and the Department of Corrections, all three of them declined to comment for this story. But no, it's definitely a continuing legal battle that will continue to cover.
And we have another execution scheduled for January.
Late January is when that's scheduled to take place. It's unclear at this moment. A lot of things are in flux about when the actual trial will take place in terms of deciding whether or not how Missouri is carrying out executions is constitutional at all. That was originally scheduled to take place in September. A judge had moved it up into January to expedite the process, but now it's before a different judge. So it's really in flux right now.
Do you have any sense of why Missouri suddenly is on seemingly a fast track in the execution business after having a hiatus for some time?
Well, this isn't something that's intrinsic to Missouri. A lot of states are having problems getting a hold of drugs that can be used in executions. And the reason for that is because these private companies don't want their drugs to be used in executions. And if that's the case, then you're resorting to pharmacies that are going to mix it up. And if this pharmacy is going to be willing to do it, most of them don't want to be known for doing it. So they want their name to be confidential. It's something that we're going to see a lot more of, I think.
You have really two related issues here. There's the direct question of the execution and how it's carried out, and then there's the question of how much of that should be public information. And there are court battles going on both fronts.
Of course, the ACLU is right in the middle of all this and is very much on the record against the death penalty, period.
Yes, against the death penalty and against the government secrecy over this. The Attorney General's office and the Governor's office and the Department of Corrections all maintain that this is something that has to be kept secret, while the ACLU is obviously saying, you know, how can we be sure that everything is on the up and up if we can't provide any oversight?
Well, it's a good story. It's a complicated story. And I would direct our listeners to our website at stlpublicradio.org, where you have it all in great detail and laid out very, very nicely. Chris McDaniel, anything you want to add before we thank you?
No. Just want to add that, you know, this was co-reported with Veronique LaCapra, our science reporter.
Absolutely want to point that out. And we listened to your report this morning. I gather it will be repeated later today, probably.
It will be.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you once again, Chris McDaniel, and congratulations on a great story.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to another story that's gotten a lot of attention this past year, and we have alluded to it, Margie and I, earlier. And we bring in Tim Lloyd to talk about that now, and that is the school transfer issue, Tim. We've been talking about it for a long time. As a matter of fact, I think we've been talking about it for about 20 years, right. But it's really come to a head in recent months. Where are we right now with that?
Well, the transfer process is in full swing within the St. Louis County area. There's two unaccredited districts in North St. Louis County, Riverview Gardens and Normandy. And under the law, they have to provide transportation to an accredited district in the same or adjoining county. They also have to pay for tuition to any district, accredited district in the same or adjoining county. And of course, it is in full swing. Students are being bused all over the region. And right now, you know, probably the most pressing issue for as far as the unaccredited districts are concerned is Normandy may no longer be able to cover the costs of student transfers by this spring.
We're talking millions of dollars. This is not loose change by any stretch.
No, not at all. It's costing the Normandy School District approximately $1.5 million a month.
Okay. Well, this has got to be resolved somehow. What are the options for making this a little easier to deal with?
Well, there's a few proposals that have been put out there. It no doubt will be brought up during the coming legislative session in Jefferson City. You know, there's no doubt that the law will be changed. How it will be changed remains to be seen. There's proposals to put a tuition cap into place for the unaccredited districts. That's been met with mixed reactions. There's also proposed changes to how districts are accredited. So there's a bipartisan plan from a group of state senators that would accredit individual schools rather than an entire district.
This is going to be a really tough issue to find a compromise position on, I think, because there's so many facets to the question. There's so many extremely interested parties, highly motivated parties, and there are differences over every aspect of how to do this. It involves money. It involves politics. It involves educational philosophy. It involves the existing divisions of race and class in the region. It's just an extremely, extremely difficult and important question.
It's Margie and Tim, this is an issue that really has to be resolved by the state legislature, though, doesn't it?
To a certain extent, it does. But the state legislature has to take control of this particular situation because it's just not a sustainable situation financially right now. Longer term, it's really a question of how do you provide a good education for everybody, and that is state and local.
And one thing that you find when you talk to educators or parents or public officials, almost universally they bring up the fact that this school transfer process has really brought to the forefront what are we doing to make sure students everywhere get a quality education.
Do you have any sense of why the legislature didn't deal with it the last session?
Well, for one, it was the law was upheld by the Missouri Supreme Court after they were out of session.
So that
they could see it coming, I think. It's been brewing for this particular version of it for at least a couple years. And I think it was just too tough to be solved until it progressed a little bit.
And the law has been on the books, I believe, since 1993.
Yes,
so it's
true.
been around for a long time. One final point, Tim. I'll turn to you for this. Early on, when this thing was perking, and they were talking about moving students to Francis Howell from Normandy Riverview Gardens, whatever, there was some very caustic and racially sensitive comments that were made. Mm-hmm. There was some concern that this was going to be a real problem for the incoming students. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem to work out that way.
It sure didn't. You know, Chris was actually at the meeting at Francis Howell High School shortly after this transfer process was put in place, and there were some awfully negative reactions from some of those parents. But I can tell you that I was at a meeting at the Normandy School District just a few weeks later, and there were parents who came in from Francis Howell and said, "Listen, we welcome your students." So it doesn't seem to be as big of a problem as perhaps it could have been.
Chris, let me turn to you with regard to that coverage on that first night. Are you surprised that it turned out as well as it has, given the comments that were made that evening?
I think a lot of times when there's a big change, it can be exaggerated by the people who are about ready to expect that change. And I think that a lot of the concerns were over-exaggerated, and there haven't been as many problems as there were before. So it shouldn't be too surprising that it wasn't as it wasn't the Armageddon that a lot of people, you know, said it was going to be. But yeah,
I think what actually happened is people who felt differently about it and really did feel a sense of responsibility stepped up. You don't always see that happen. Sometimes people are intimidated and they don't speak out. But in this case, I think eventually they did. And it really changed the tone of the whole situation.
You have to give the kids a lot of credit, too, because they were right in the middle of all of this, and they seemed to handle it better than some of their adults, some of their parents did.
Sure.
Yeah. Got to stop it right there. I want to thank you both, Chris McDaniel and Tim Lloyd, for being with us. And as we continue our 2013 year in review, we'll continue to do that in just a moment. When we come back, we'll be going to Illinois and talking with Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio about some of the big stories over in that state. So stay with us. And we'll want your comment, too. What events do you think had the most impact on the region and perhaps on yourself during the past 12 months or so? Back in just a moment. Marty Farvel will stay with us. You do too, please. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation, looking back at the year 2013. It's our year in review, an annual exercise. But before we continue that conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom is following today. The Affordable Care Act goes into effect at midnight. About 200,000 Missourians fall into a coverage gap, meaning they can't get federal assistance to get insurance in the marketplace, but they also don't qualify for Medicaid because Missouri did not expand the program. In 2014, Missouri legislators may revisit the idea of a 1% sales tax for high-priority road projects. And Illinois' new medical marijuana law goes into effect tomorrow. You can hear more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation about the year in review. Margie Freivogel is with me in studio, and we're being joined now by Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio. Amanda, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Or nice afternoon, I guess.
yeah, it is this afternoon. Nice to talk to you again, Amanda. This has been a busy and significant year for you and for the state of Illinois, has it not?
Better believe it. A lot of issues that have been festering for years, some for decades even, finally got passed, for better or for worse, depending on your perspective, of course, but did get through the General Assembly this year. Very active legislative session.
Let's take them one at a time. We'll start with pension reform, which has been a bugaboo for many years now.
Exactly. So Illinois has gotten infamous for having the worst funded pension system in the nation, primarily because for years, legislators, instead of putting in the state's share into state employees' retirement funds, instead put it on other more fun things that they could go home and brag about to voters. And that, of course, accompanied with the economic downturn, left Illinois' pensions, again, worst funded in the nation. And And it has been particularly a tough issue for legislators to deal with. Well, first of all, they themselves are earning pensions, but also because there is a constitutional promise in Illinois' state constitution that says pension benefits shall not be diminished nor impaired. That was supposed to be the guarantee that something like the law would never happen, but also because it is the pensions of many of the state's public school teachers as well as state employees. And so those are very powerful when it comes to election time, powerful when it comes to getting out the vote and putting money into legislators' campaigns. So all of those issues put together made it very tough for legislators to get anything passed. But this year, they managed to get it done.
So is this the end of it?
Oh, no.
My question is, have they finally decided to come to grips with reality, or maybe not so much?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, who knows, first of all? So it's not done because there is going to be a lawsuit. There's already been one lawsuit by retired teachers that has been filed, but expect more, particularly coming from those unions, to be filed. And so it will presumably be left up to the state Supreme Court to determine whether the law that basically cuts state employees' pension benefits. That's, of course, how Illinois is able to, you know, get the savings. You've got to cut the fat somewhere, and so that's what they did, something that union members say is not only unfair but unconstitutional, hence this lawsuit. So that will really determine it. And, you know, for some people, it is cut and dry. You look at that line in the state constitution that says, again, pension benefits shall not be diminished nor impaired. What possibly could the court say that would go around that? That said, I think the Affordable Care Act, for example, as you mentioned, showed that you never know what justices are going to pull out, what part of law or previous case they may go back to and cite. And so it really depends on that. Outside, of course, the main pension question, you also have a lot of Illinois municipalities that are struggling to pay what are owed, or that will be struggling at least to pay their retirees. And so look for the General Assembly to have to go back to the pension question.
A couple of hot button issues you could bring us up to speed on, Amanda. That is conceal and carry and gay marriage, two other big issues in front of the state this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's start with concealed carry, because Illinois was actually last in the nation to have any sort of law that would allow individuals, or at least regular individuals, you know, we're not talking about police or anything, but to be able to carry a firearm in public. And so this was something that Illinois, controlled by Democrats, and a lot of them from Chicago, where, of course, there is a major problem with violence and gangs and all sorts of gun-related deaths and murders, they didn't want to have to pass this, but it was a court order that basically forced Illinois to pass this concealed carry law. We haven't seen it actually take effect yet. The state police are going to be within the first days of the new year beginning to accept applications for concealed carry licenses. And so we'll see if it changes the climate in Illinois at all. You're going to again continue to see, I think, legislators revisit this issue. Those who favor gun rights seeking to have a more open concealed carry law where they want guns to be allowed in additional places and are going to continue to fight for rights in that regard, but also, again, those Chicago area legislators in particular that are seeking to get guns, for example, out of any restaurant that serves alcohol. That is something that is in the law now. So that issue is also not complete, and I expect we'll see that not only in the General Assembly, but also in the courts.
And same-sex marriage?
So, yeah, same-sex marriage, that's one that did happen somewhat quickly. Of course, that's an issue that has been around for a long time, as has, again, pensions and the gun matter. But you saw Illinois not all that long ago enact civil unions. And it was said at the time, yes, you know, the critics said, hey, this is just going to be a gateway for same-sex marriage. And some of the individuals who had passed that said, yeah, maybe, but I don't think we're anywhere near close. Got close pretty darn quick. We saw that be a big issue actually in the spring, and division within the gay rights community when there was no vote called. But again, the legislator came back. We saw a handful of Republicans go along with that measure, even though you have a super majority, historic super majorities of Democrats in both the Illinois House and Senate. Democrats alone didn't have the votes to pass it. So as we look ahead to the 2014 elections, it will remain to be seen, in particular, how those Republicans who stuck their necks out and went against the party mainstream and voting for same-sex marriage are going to fare. Whereas Illinois did become, in a sense, the 15th state to allow it, nobody can, or at least most people can't actually, most same-sex couples can't actually get married yet. It doesn't actually take effect until June, with the exception being some people, if you're in a partnership where one of the members is gravely ill, for example. You saw in the Cook County clerk, and again, this is an area where same-sex marriage is very popular versus downstate where it has not proven to be so as much. The Cook County clerk is issuing marriage permits to same-sex couples in those cases.
Our time is winding down, but I did want to make mention of the medical marijuana law, which goes into effect tomorrow. We just mentioned that in our news headlines.
Exactly. So that's another biggie, something that legislators have tried and tried and tried to vote on and just never had the votes to pass. Those, I think, Democratic supermajorities were able to put it over. It's technically law starting the first of the year, although it's going to be a while before that actually happens because you need state agencies to promulgate rules and such. But Illinois backers say that it is the strictest in the nation. So don't look for anything like California or Colorado where it would be easy to get your hands on pot. You need to follow very specific procedures and have a very specific set of diseases or conditions in order to get doctor's authorization for that.
Well, Amanda Vinicky, it sounds like you're going to have another busy year ahead of you. It certainly was busy these past several months. We appreciate so much your being with us. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
The pleasure was mine. Happy New Year to you all.
Same to you, Amanda Vinicky. Great talking to you. Turn back to our studio now, and Joe Manis of St. Louis Public Radio and The Beacon joins us in studio. And, Joe, I guess we're going to talk politics with you. Are you up for a little political chit-chat?
Yeah, politics and probably a little bit of government because it's all entwined.
It surely is. It's been such a busy year. As you look back, what stands out in your mind?
Well, there's several major things, and some may not seem major to the listeners, but I think they'll have a big impact. There's the ongoing fight over the Medicaid expansion that is part policy but part political. That's still going on in Jefferson City. The governor earlier today reaffirmed his call to expand, try to get the Medicaid expansion in the state. The Republican legislative leaders disagree on part of its philosophical grounds. They don't believe in it, that they don't think as Rick Stream, the budget director, has said here on the podcast a few weeks ago, they don't believe that able-bodied people should be getting Medicaid. I mean, this is how he puts it. And they also feel that this is something that they ran on when they amassed their large majorities in 2010. And here they are heading into another election year, 2014. So you've got many legislative leaders in Jefferson City who feel that they can't back away from that. Now, the only thing that might change is if the hospitals, particularly in rural areas, have been putting on a lot of pressure to try to get them to change. So they're going to continue doing that. But I, frankly, from talking to legislative leaders the last few days for some stories, it doesn't appear that they're going to budge. They're saying they're going to talk more about the tax cut, which the governor blocked this summer, in which they did not override, which was for businesses and for individuals. Mm-hmm. There's a whole host of tax cut proposals that have already been pre-filed in Jeff City. And so what I've been told is that tax cuts and the school transfer will probably be the big issues this session. And so they're not going to be talking about Medicaid, mm-hmm. or at least not that much, or at least not that early.
Well, this Medicaid situation brings up something that's really an underlying theme in a lot of the major political stories and disputes, and that is the extent to which ideology or political philosophy plays a major role in what people do. When there are attempts to find a compromise or a consensus, if you're dealing in terms of dollars or immediate practical implications, it's a lot easier to find common ground than if people are really set on their principles. And it's interesting to see that play out. And you have even some differences within the Republican Party on matters like that.
Yes, although in Missouri there are less – let's put it this way. The ones who feel strongly about this on a philosophical ground are the ones who are in control in this state.
How many people are we talking about who are affected by this? I've seen the figure 200, 300,000.
Yes.
Is that right?
The estimate is between 200 and 300,000.
Right.
Because and you have to – when you go back to 2005, when Missouri cut its eligibility requirements and that tossed out or cut benefits – for about 300,000 people who either lost all or part of their benefits.
You mentioned the 2014 election season. What are you seeing over the horizon right now with regard to that?
Well, in Missouri, we only have one statewide office that's going to be on the ballot, mm-hmm. and that's state auditor. And Tom Schweik, who's a Republican, is the incumbent. Right now, there is a Democratic candidate, a legislator from Kansas City, but that field may still be shaking out on the Democratic side, but there's a lot of predictions that that may not be – when it's just state auditor, which only happens once in about every 20 years, that it's just the state auditor when it doesn't mesh with a Senate race, as it did in 2010. That can affect turnout, but there will probably be a number of ballot issues as a result. Right now, if you compare – this year with 2010, while people still have to get the signatures, there's a good almost twice as many initiatives have been approved for circulation. Doesn't mean they're out there, but they've been approved for circulation as in 2010. So I predict that what will drive turnout, if anything, in the state will be ballot issues. Now, that's how the gay marriage ban got passed in 2004. So where you had a ballot initiative that actually became the marquee thing on the ballot. So and it, now, of course, in the St. Louis area, it's also going to be the county executive's race, which is big.
I was just about to bring that up, and there have been some things going on recently which people are looking at. Some might have thought that Mr. Dooley might have had a relatively easy ride to the finish line, but some things have been going on lately that might prevent that from happening.
Yes, they've had a number of controversies in their administration. You know, they had that health department official. It looked like that he had been embezzling. You know, he shot himself. There's been a couple other – there's been some FBI investigations. Now, nothing has directly connected to Dooley. But when you're the chief executive, whether it's the county or wherever, you're the one that's going to be in the spotlight when you have those kind of controversies. So he already has one major opponent, which is County Councilman Steve Stenger, a fellow Democrat, which also means that that fight will likely be fought in August, not in November, because right now the Republicans, even with the split in the Democratic ranks, have not come up with a high-profile candidate to run for county executive. Now, that may change. Filing doesn't start until the end of February. But right now, there is no major high-profile Republican running, which means the big fight for county executive could be in August. So that's kind of like before the big show in November. Sure. It could all be settled.
Well, the controversy over the county police board really was enmeshed in the larger political situation.
Yeah. And may have cost Tim Fitch his job. He retired to want to do other things, but you have to believe that it was associated somehow with his problems with Mr. Dooley.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say for sure. Now, the St. Louis City Police Chief, Sam Dotson, who I had talked to actually that morning, who has regular breakfasts or lunches mm-hmm. with Fitch, he contended that it was because the primary reason was that because Fitch had reached for the last year the maximum amount of pension that he could get, mm-hmm. and that he said this often happens in law enforcement where then you decide what's the next big thing. And if you're experienced in law enforcement, there are extremely lucrative jobs out there. And so he contends it was that. So I'm not saying – but
That's the official version. Anyway.
Right. But on the other hand, there's no question that there was tensions between Fitch and Dooley. And the fallout is that the kind of elephant in the room in St. Louis County, which is, you know, prosecuting attorney Bob McCullough, has endorsed Stinger. Mm-hmm. And McCullough, for years, had been encouraged by Democrats, fellow Democrats, because he's a Democrat, to run for county executive himself, to run for Congress, to do something. McCullough says he's not going to do it. You know, he's been that way for 10 years. But this is the first time that he's come out and says, I don't want the county. So McCullough, depending on how active he is, could be sort of a major player in what happens in this county executive fight between Stinger and Dooley.
I have to take a break. I want to come back and talk more politics with Joe Manis and Margie Freivogel as we continue our 2013 year in review, but I have to take this break. Let's do that now. We'll come back and we'll take some calls, too. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our 2013 year in review. With me in studio is Margie Freivogel, who is the St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon editor, and Joe Manis, who reports for the same organization, basically on politics. Joe, so many things to talk about, but I do want to bring in the re-election of Francis Slay. That was a big, big story. And,
yes.
And a historic history-making event.
Yes. After a few months after he won re-election and was sworn in, he became officially the longest-serving mayor in St. Louis history. And while many of the listeners may think, you know, okay, so what? It actually is a big deal, and not just for historical reasons. When you have somebody who's in office for a really long time, and in this case, as I said, the longest-serving mayor, it's not just what they do, it's how they are perceived. So when Slay says something, whether one agrees or disagrees, his critics and his supporters acknowledge that it carries some weight, and not just locally, but nationally, because he is seen as one of the veteran mayors in the country. So even if you're a critic of what he's been doing, and there has been a lot more scrutiny of, like all mayors, all three-term mayors, now he's in his fourth, but there's always been an effort by the mayors to expand their power because technically St. Louis has a weak mayor system. Slay has been more successful than any of them in changing that, and not just from the standpoint of being a bully pulpit. Him getting control of the police department for St. Louis City Hall is a big, big deal. And it may not sound like a big deal now because everything seems the same, but over the years, it will continue to be an even bigger deal because St. Louis City Hall now controls the budget. We'll have a major voice in the staffing, major voice in a lot of things going on in the police department. And that had been a sore spot for mayors for 150 years, and it also cut into their power. It wasn't just, I mean, part of it's government, but in government, there's government and there's politics, and it mixes.
Yeah, I always thought with that the use of the term local control was a little bit of a misnomer because the police board, although it was appointed by the governor, it was local people. So it's really a question of shifting the power from the state to the city, even though the players involved were all St. Louisans.
Yes. Now, in the old days, back in the 80s, particularly 80s and early 90s, before term limits really hit the legislature, see, and this is where things mesh. The long-term state legislators, especially state senators, really were the major powers controlling the police department. Mm-hmm. They had huge effects over appointments.
Jet Banks,
John Scott. They were major players in determining who got promotions, the whole thing. Yep. And that affected, frankly, how the police department ran. Now, with term limits, which have now been in effect in the state for over a decade, that has reduced that power. So in some ways, then the police board, which is controlled by the governor, took on a more high-profile role. Before, the police board privately also had to be very cooperative with the state legislators. As I said, when you had long-term state legislators who were in office 20 or 30 years and who called the shots on the budget for the police department, in effect. So that's all changed. And so now it's City Hall.
Right. lots to talk about. I have to move along to some other things. Joe, stay with us. I'm going to take a call now from Scott in Chesterfield because I think it will relate to one of your areas of expertise. Go ahead, Scott. You're on the air.
Yeah, the federal government has been sending Medicaid money to Missouri for years, decades. They've been sending highway money for decades, and they've been fairly predictable, So, if anyone's unpredictable, it's this wacky Missouri legislature. Sending Medicaid, our Medicaid tax dollars to other states, which that's jobs, they turned down the China thing for the airport. That's jobs. They're making Missouri look like a bunch of ignorant, backwards people. I don't know how long are the voters going to put up with that?
Okay, thank you so much for the call, Joe. You've heard this song before.
Yes, in fact, what he's talking about in jobs is probably the message that the governor and the hospitals have been saying, because they've been contending that expanding Medicaid in the state would add 24,000 jobs, most of them healthcare related. The Republican critics have said whether or not that's true, that's not the point. To them, it's the point is they don't think the state should be expanding. They don't think the federal government should be expanding. Now, some of this will be affected by whether or not the Affordable Care Act, which had a pretty rocky rollout a few months ago, appears to be smoother. The stuff that goes on with the Affordable Care Act over the next few months nationally actually could very well have an impact here in Missouri, because the end of the people signing up for insurance for this first round ends at the end of March, which is about in the middle of the session. Mm-hmm. And if by that time things are going smooth nationally, and if things look better as far as the Missouri sign-ups, because we have to use the federal exchange because they didn't set up a state exchange, there's a possibility that could affect some of the discussion. But so the Missouri fight is in some ways connected to the national fight. That's my point.
Joe, stay with us. I'm going to have to turn away from politics a little bit now to get some of the other things into this program that should be there. I have an email here from Lawrence, for instance, who said the biggest local news stories of the year for a general interest story that garnered the attention of the whole country. You cannot deny that the biggest story was the death of Stan the Man. Margie, what do you think?
Well, that's certainly touches a lot of hearts for people here. And there was a sort of perfect melding, I think, of the kind of person Stan Musial was and the things that St. Louisans admire. He was a humble man. He was excellent at what he did. He worked hard, and he stayed dedicated to St. Louis for his entire life. Who could be better?
And, Joe, we lost Ike Skelton, former congressman.
Yes, and Ike Skelton was a major player. He was the congressman from southwest Missouri, the Democrat, conservative Democrat. I actually knew him pretty well back in the day when I was in the Washington Bureau and Margie was in the Washington Bureau. And he was a major powerhouse on the military front. Had been chairman of the Armed Services Committee, had a lot of influence, had some personal injuries. So actually for years, Dick Gephardt had actually been his driver, driving him to the Capitol for a long time. And Joanne Emerson actually then took over some of the duties. Skelton's loss in 2010 also, which was by Vicky Hartzler, the Republican, also set in motion a whole bunch of dominoes. So it wasn't just Ike Skelton powerhouse. His loss set the stage for what ended up being redistricting that cost Russ Carnahan his seat. And many of us felt that if Ike Skelton had won re-election in 2010, he might have announced that then he was going to retire in 2012, and the boundary lines in the state would have been very different for the loss of the congressional seat. So there's so many things that fit together. His loss politically and, of course, as a person, was very major in the state.
You've mentioned that a couple of times, how so many of these things fit together. You really have to look very closely sometimes to realize that. We also had a number of people who emailed us and tweeted lamenting the death of Rob Reuter, who was the disc jockey and musician who walked into an elevator shaft a couple of months ago and killed
right,
himself. A lot of
right.
people commented that that should be among the top stories.
Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, there we're touching on now really some cultural things.
Yeah.
And there were a number of very important things in that area this year. And the Bob Reuter's death, I know, was really important to a lot of people. He was very much admired. You had the opening of the new wing at the Art Museum. That was a major thing. It's a reminder of what a rich place St. Louis is culturally.
City Library, too, I think it was this year that they reopened that after the renovation.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Which is just gorgeous. No,
it's wonderful. A couple of other things I want to mention just to acknowledge the fact that we didn't forget about them. We mentioned local control. Joe, you're way ahead of me on that one. Boeing incentives, which is an ongoing story. We'll be hearing more about that. The Peabody Patriot bankruptcy ruling, which affected thousands and thousands of pensioners in our area. We've mentioned Larry Connors, and I think we can move along from that. We had the Cardinals in the World Series. Didn't win, but it's always nice to be there in any case. There are many other things as well, but one of the things I wanted to talk about, at least briefly, was the clown story out of the State Fair in Sedalia and the national attention that got. One of our callers earlier talked about how we are made to look bad nationally by some of the things our legislature does from time to time. Let me get your sense, Margaret, I'll start with you, to how that story played. You'll remember that the clown
dressed
as Barack
Obama. I do remember the story,
Obama.
And Joe was one of the first people to be reporting on that story, and it did it become a national story, and not showing Missouri in the best light, I don't think.
Yeah, and it whether one agrees or disagrees, it definitely put a lot of attention on our state. For listeners, this was a guy who during the rodeo put on an Obama clown, and then there was another guy through the mic who was making some comments indirectly about going to get you, trying to get this bull mm-hmm. to go after him. And there's been talk lately of actually honoring the clown. I mean, this is, in some ways, this represents the rural-urban divide, not just in Missouri, but in the nation. I mean, there's certain parts of the country, like the southern states, and where they see things very differently. And this has become much more polarized. And that episode in some ways reflected the polarization within the state. I mean, in my lifetime, in everybody's lifetime in this room, rural Missouri used to be represented by conservative Democrats. Now they're all represented by conservative Republicans. And this episode sort of reflected just a different worldview. I mean, because the people who were involved contended that they were not out to insult the president.
We have
and
one
the
minute.
People who felt insulted felt that there were racist overtones
Correct.
To it and that it was highly insulting.
Correct.
We have just about a minute left, and I'd be terribly remiss if I didn't mention Larry Biondi and the fact that he left after 25 years as the top man at St. Louis University. Mark, your thoughts about that? That surprised a lot of people that it came to that and came so quickly.
I think there's an example of someone whose greatest strengths became perhaps the weakness that brought him down. He was such a strong person, such a strong personality. It allowed him to accomplish many things. But in the end, he wasn't listening when people said they needed a bigger voice in what was going on. And I think that eventually led to his departure.
But you can't walk around Midtown St. Louis and not be fully aware of his accomplishments in terms of what he did for St. Louis University in this part of the city.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at this part of the city where we're sitting now and compare it to 25 years ago, I mean, it's just light years. And, Father Biondi deserves a lot of the credit. It's sometimes visionary people, they run it. It becomes a controversy at some point, but the vision does make a difference.
No question about it. That's Joe Manis. Joe, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Marja Freivogel, great to see you. Congratulations on the big story breaking today as a result of the people under your banner, if you will.
Thanks so much for being with us.
That would have been Chris McDaniel and Veronica LaCapra. Chris was with us. Joe Manis, I've mentioned, Amanda Vinicky from Illinois Public Radio joined us as well, as did Tim Lloyd of our staff. Tomorrow, St. Louis on the Air is preempted for the Capitol Steps New Year's special. We'll be back on Thursday. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Happy New Year, everybody. Auld Lang Syne. Thanks for listening.